sun will shine beyond the moon. There my true love will come shine.
The great art of a cappella, none better than the Persuasions. And on this day in 1945, as I said earlier, the great J. Otis was born on this day. J. Otis Washington, one of the lead singers of the Persuasions, was born on this day in 1945. So happy birthday, J. Otis. And we share some of his music with all of our guests in the beginning of our segments. Also reminding you, on our way to this conversation, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank, belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com. We are going to talk about the White House report on sexual assaults on our campuses in the course of this next hour. And the White House Task Force to Protect Students from Sexual Assault came out and had a lot of controversy around it. It said that 1 out of 5 women were sexually assaulted. Some people think the number is a great deal higher. There was some conservative pushback that said that actually we're expanding the notion of sexual assault beyond the realm where it should be. That would tread on people's rights. We'll talk about that. We'll look at what this means and what our campuses are doing. Other reports have come out. And on the heels of that, we're a local university where we broadcast from here, Johns Hopkins University, has been accused of not reporting a gang rape that took place, not letting its students know that a gang rape took place in a fraternity. And it's a very complex subject. It's a very important subject. Much of this is fueled by activists, mostly women on campuses, who had been sexually assaulted. They kind of began forcing this issue. And we're going to wrestle with all this hour with our guests. We are joined here in studio by a number of folks who are on our panel. One second here as we get these notes together. Where are they all? Here we go. Sorry, folks. We are joined here by Dani McLean. I picked up her piece on Friday in The Nation magazine. She's joining us now as a contributor to TheNation.com, where she reports on gender, reproductive health, and sexuality, and is a fellow of The Nation Institute. And Dani, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We are also joined here by B.C. Uchabadejaw, who is a Baltimore attorney with Ballard Spahr, advises colleges and universities on compliance with Title IX on the civil rights laws. Good to have you in the studio as well.
Thank you.
Amanda Cardone-Liven is with us. She's a victim advocate with Turnaround on Sexual Assault, Domestic Violence, and Human Sex Trafficking Victim Service provider here in Baltimore City and Maryland. Good to have you back in the studio.
Thank you.
And Dr. Lawrence Brown is with us, political activist, public health consultant, and assistant professor of public health here at the School of Community Health and Policy at Morgan State University. Good to see you, Lawrence.
Good morning.
And you all are with us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. One of the things I said half-jokingly before we began this conversation, BC, was that since you're a Title IX attorney, is that when most people hear Title IX, the first thing they think about is sports. I think people don't understand the breadth of what this actually meant.
Right, exactly. And so Title IX covers athletics, as everybody generally knows, but it also covers issues of harassment, including sexual harassment and sexual violence, as well as issues around transgender students and their rights and disparate treatment of women and men on campus. So there's a wide range of issues covered by Title IX.
Dani, you wrote some really great piece in The Nation last week after this happened. I'm curious if you would just give a quick analysis of what this really means and what the breadth of this is or isn't.
Right. So what is interesting here is that the White House has formed a task force specifically to deal with sexual assault on campus. And as part of that, they released a list of 55 colleges and universities that are currently under investigation by the Department of Education for potentially being in violation of Title IX. There's no being on the list does not necessarily mean that they are doing something wrong. It just means that it's time for a compliance review, or they've received reports from students that there may be a problem on these campuses. So what's exciting about this is that, I spoke with student activists who have been really pushing their campus administrations to deal with the problem of sexual assault on their campus. And what they all said was that the White House getting involved in forming this task force and publishing this list is really a great first step, because it shows that they're serious about enforcing Title IX in a way that students have not been confident that that the Department of Education, has been serious in the past. It shows a real new commitment to transparency and to coordinating efforts between the Department of Education and the Department of Justice. So these students say, this is great because now it looks like the federal government will be doing the work that we as students have felt that we have, had to do for years now. The kind of consensus among the students that I've talked to and read about is that, it's really been on them to point out to their campus administrators that, they're not doing what they should be doing in terms of investigating these reports of sexual assault, and that they're not doing enough to respond to the needs of survivors, victims, the young people on campuses who have alleged that they've been victims of sexual assault. So, what it is a good first step in terms of new transparency, in terms of coordinating efforts on the federal level, in terms of, the White House task force has said that they're going to institute a campus climate survey and possibly require schools to conduct this survey in 2016. So it shows a kind of invigorated effort on the part of the feds to really get involved. The students I spoke to said that, time will tell whether they're really serious about enforcement and what kind of sanctions schools will face in terms of, not living up to what they should be doing under Title IX.
There are two things here I really want to examine, and one has to do with the notion of power inside universities and what this has to do with that, which I'll come to in a moment. But I want to start, first of all, with this whole about the notion of sexual assault. Not notion, I even use it that way. Sexual assault and what that means and how we define it. Because I think part of the misunderstanding, part of the blowback that you hear from a lot of people, especially conservative talk show hosts and other groups that deal with individual rights, been writing about critiquing this thing to even to you hear some people on campus, especially men, talking about what this means, is that this is a personal responsibility. What do we mean by sexual assault? I mean, how is this definition? What does this definition mean to us all? How do we define that? I mean, we, in some senses, redefining it in the sense that there are many men who do things. Let me just put it out here: there are many men who do things sexually with women that don't see it as assault to start with.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true.
Right?
It's absolutely true that men do. Approach women, first of all, as objects. We live in a society where men objectify women. And I think that's gone back quite a long way. Even if you go back to the period of enslavement, when human beings were objectified, black women were viewed as objects. And I think white women were too. When you look at the Salem witch trials, women have been viewed as not fully human. And so I think once you dehumanize someone, that's often the next step to mistreating them or abusing them. And so I think to carry that forward to where we are today, we live in a society where we look at gender pay issues, we look at other rights that women don't have as fully equal to as men when compared to men. And I think it shows us that in this society, men do not view women as equal beings, equal partners. And so I think this lends itself, when I think about masculinity, I think about Western masculinity is really, it's defined around control, assertiveness, dominance. And so in relationship to women, when you view them as objects, I think it lends itself to this sexual assault phenomenon that we have in our society. And it's something which I really appreciate in this report. The second piece that they wanted to do was prevent sexual assault by engaging men. And I think oftentimes we don't look at engaging men in terms of preventing. I mean, we obviously need to treat anytime this happens. We need to make sure we respond to it correctly and aggressively. But, we also need to engage men to think about how do we change the way masculinity is constructed in our society so that we can get away from notions of ownership, notions of objectification, and this leading to, I think, the assault of women sexually.
Amanda?
I definitely agree with everything he said. I also wanted to mention, in terms of what is sexual assault, as victim advocates and folks working in the anti-sexual violence field, we really see sexual assault as a continuum. And so that can be anything from sexual unwanted street harassment to, you know, a completed rape. And so we really see any kind of sexual conduct that the victim doesn't consent to, or sexual conduct where the victim is unable to consent due to capacity issues, like being too intoxicated or something like that. We see all of that as in the gamut of sexual assault, and you know, our clients have experienced vast varieties of types of sexual assault, a lot of times multiple forms by different perpetrators. And I think that some of the criticism about sexual assault numbers comes from folks that are looking at crime reporting numbers or campus reporting numbers, as opposed to random national sample in-depth research studies with people who have been survivors of sexual assault. So we know that sexual assault is a very underreported crime there. So when you're looking at official reporting numbers, you're not going to see as high of numbers as you do whenever you are looking at the CDC National Intimate Partner in Sexual Violence Survey, which, you know, had thousands and thousands of representatives and many of them had not reported to authorities.
You were about to say something, Danny, that was coming back over here. Danny, I thought I heard you trying to say something.
No, I was just, I really appreciated what the previous speaker said about the importance of involving men, you know, and one of the parts of the report that I think is important is this idea of bystander involvement and, you know, shifting culture around what men think is appropriate behavior if they are witnessing someone, being approached, talked to in a way that's inappropriate. And if you look at one of the PSAs that's come out of the task force, it includes all these celebrities, Benicio del Toro and Vice President Biden, and, you know, the kind of message throughout is if she doesn't consent or can't consent, it's rape, it's assault. And so I just, you know, I really agree with this idea of one of the important pieces that I think can come from this report and from this focus is getting men to challenge their own understanding of what's appropriate and the impact that they can have when they're witnessing something that could be sexual assault or the start of an inappropriate situation.
Right, and I think that's absolutely right. And I think one of the key issues that has come up is what it means, like you said, Mark, to for a person to be sexually assaulted. I think one of the areas about which there's much confusion and lack of information is that many men, women, who may be people who are considered to have committed a sexual assault, may not understand that if the other person is very intoxicated or otherwise under the influence of alcohol or drugs and unable to give consent, blacks out, that if you engage in sexual intercourse with that person, even if you think it's consensual, if you find yourself in the disciplinary panel, you might find yourself with the outcome of a hearing saying that you have committed sexual assault because that person is unable to give consent. And I think one of the key issues that colleges and universities are taking on is how to educate men and women about the definition of sexual assault and to make sure that students understand what that definition is, understand what consent is, and are informed as they start from their first years.
So, BC, I'm curious, as an attorney working with colleges, this one of the questions I want to ask you, and we can all kind of wrestle with this together, I mean, what kind of questions are universities asking about this? I mean, since you're advising them, and you know, what are the complexities that they're trying to wrestle with here? That they, I mean, because some people might think, well, okay, let me stop there,
okay,
and I'll throw in my other idea after that. Let's just stop there.
Okay, I mean, I think one of the issues is around training. So, how much training do students need to receive about this? When do they need to be trained? Who needs to receive this training? Another issue is making sure that faculty and staff understand their responsibilities when they receive a report of sexual harassment or sexual assault. So I think issues around consent, issues around who is responsible for reporting are very big issues for colleges. And then also making sure their policies and procedures are compliant. The Office for Civil Rights has lots of requirements around what constitutes a compliant policy. The White House has even more recommendations. So there's lots and lots of information about what should go into policies. And colleges need to also make sure that they're clear so that somebody who has experienced trauma can understand and follow the required policies. So there are lots of issues now for schools.
Just reminding our listeners, you just heard Basi Okubadeja, who is an attorney with Ballard Spahr, who advises universities. Dana McLean writes for The Nation on gender issues. She joins us by phone. Amanda Cordone-Lyben is with us, who works with sexual assault victims. A group called Turnaround here in Baltimore deals with sexual violence and trafficking. Dr. Lawrence Brown, professor of public health here at Morgan State University. 410-319-8888 is the number here. There are a couple of questions here I want to kind of wrestle with. Part of the issue, it seems to me, when I hear anecdotal stories from people about what's happened, whether it's in the universities the size of Morgan State University or large institutions like Johns Hopkins or smaller places that have a more intimate setting of 1,000 students or 500 students, that part of the problem is power. That, and by power I mean very specifically, that students who are in frats, who are come from families with a certain amount of political and financial power, or financial power if nothing else, universities want that financial power. Things get overlooked a lot because of that. There's a lot of internal politics within universities around this. And how do we address that? I mean, this is one of the complexities of these issues that you hear all the time in universities.
Right.
Whether it's a failing student getting through because their daddy has money or whatever else.
I think there's a third group that we certainly ought to pay attention to, and that's athletes as well. We've heard about Jameis Winston and his case, and multiple athletes that particularly seems like with football that if a young man is playing football, he's somehow shielded from prosecution, shielded from the legal system working the way that it should. And so I think you're right when you have young men that come from families of power, fraternities, which all often have a culture of boys will be boys, and I think even administrators and staff viewing them as such, and then athletes who have a particular amount of power. I think with the power often comes the shielding. Look at Penn State University, right, Jerry Sandusky. We're going to shield the program by not really investigating, and it took them 10-plus years to really dig into what was really going on. And so I think with the power of men also comes the shielding of administration that's often not addressed as well.
Amanda, go ahead.
And that's something that I think is really strong in the White House report. They really emphasize transparency, the importance of transparency for these disciplinary proceedings. And they also emphasize the importance of community partnerships. And so campuses partnering with their local, their designated rape crisis center, other service providers, and also, with local law enforcement and other officials as well, which I think will increase transparency because, victims really suffer whenever they're in a system where things aren't transparent, where it's not clear what outcomes are going to be or what sanctions are going to be, and also whenever they're not clear about who is going to be able to provide confidential services or not, or when confidentiality might be violated. I also wanted to mention, BC mentioned the importance for training for students, and the White House report also talks about the importance of trauma-informed training for staff and faculty. A lot of times these staff and faculty that are, kind of heading these disciplinary proceedings might not have any formal training in sexual assault or in law for that manner or in disciplinary proceedings. And so I think really understanding what the survivor's going through is really important.
So, what do we think? What's the biggest gap at this moment between what the White House recommends in this kind of in the piece they put out and what schools are already doing or not doing? I mean, what's the hole that has to be filled here? And can universities do the job? Is it something that's is that part of the problem? Is part of the problem is maybe some of this stuff should be taken outside the university and not be at the foot of administrators. They're maybe not capable of handling this. Maybe it's be outside their realm, either in an external panel or the legal system or however that might be.
I think one of the main issues is training. If you have a hearing panel that is well-trained and if you have a campus community that is well-trained, you'll have reporting and you'll have reports that are channeled to the appropriate sources and handled properly. I think many complainants do file complaints with law enforcement, but those are handled, you know, completely separately under higher legal standards, and often those cases are not successful. But I think the statistics also show that most people who complain about sexual assault are telling the truth. And so if most people who complain about sexual assault on campus are telling the truth, and if these cases aren't being handled or aren't being handled appropriately through the criminal system or aren't being taken to conviction through the criminal system, then what is happening to these people who are complaining about sexual assault on campus? So it seems like they still need services to help them complete their education on campus. There still needs to be a mechanism to make sure that campuses are safe for those students and for other students, the larger campus community. And so I think schools do have a role in this process.
Let's see what our listeners think at 410-319-8888. And Kevin, you're on the air.
Yeah, so I think it's an interesting topic, but I have a question that is this a one-sided law? And what I mean by that, I'm hearing emphasis on men and men making sexual assaults, but you know that's a two-way street. And I know, as far as statistic-wise, you hear more about men, but that goes both ways. So I just wanted to find out if that's just a one-sided law.
What do you mean it goes both ways?
Well, women make sexual assaults as well. You don't hear about it a lot, but it happens. So I'm just wondering, based on this law, is it more emphasis on men, or investigating more on men, or is it two-way street here?
Amanda, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I'm not an attorney, but in terms of Maryland law, there is a certain requirement for charges of rape or sex offense that aren't necessarily gendered, but often find themselves that way. As far as victim service providers and rape crisis providers like Turnaround, we definitely provide services to male survivors of male offenders, male survivors of female offenders, female survivors of female offenders, as well as the vast majority of our clients definitely are female survivors of male offenders, because statistically we do see that more often.
Right. And I do want to clarify in my conversation about men, the reason why I emphasized engaging men and redefining masculinity is precisely because of what the person who spoke before me just said, is that statistically men, I believe, commit over 90% of sexual assault. So it's just from a statistical perspective, we're talking about making sure that a group that is disproportionately, overwhelmingly, statistically engaging in this behavior is rethinking. We need a revolution of values as it relates to masculinity.
So how do you think that universities and other places should begin to put things into effect and change things? In other words, one of the things I read in the article is that in the report is everything from rape by a stranger or somebody to somebody dancing too close mm-hmm. to you on the dance floor. And I mean, it's a broad spectrum here. So the question is, then what should the response be? If we're talking on one hand about you have to raise the consciousness of men in this process. So what I'm curious what we think we need to begin to institute and think about on our campus is that it might also affect the larger society around this issue. We got to take a quick break. We're going to come right back to wrestle with that particular question. We'll go right to Danny and then go around the room. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I heard it through the grapevine, Smokey Robinson. Well, on this day in 1940, Norman Whitfield was born. One of the great songwriters from Motown wrote this and many, many, many other songs, saying "Too Proud to Beg," "Cloud Nine," "War," and many other things. So, happy birthday! He's still with us, Norman Whitfield. We are here now talking about this very serious task force report that came out from the White House. Many people think long overdue. We are here discussing that with Danny McLean, who is contributor to TheNation.com, where she reports on gender, reproductive health, and sexuality. She's a fellow at The Nation Institute and joins us by phone. And we're here with Bisi Okuba-Badeja, who is a Baltimore attorney with Ballard Spahr, who consults with universities and colleges on compliance with Title IX. Amanda Cardone-Liebman works with Turnaround, a victim advocate for Turnaround, and Dr. Lawrence Brown, a political activist, and is an assistant professor of public health here at Morgan State University, and you at 410-319-8888. But let me wrestle a bit here with what I was positing before we went to break. And Danny, I'll let you start off and go around the room about this kind of arc of what sexual assault is. And I think that many people, this definition for most Americans is being broadened and it has to do with wrestling with who we are. So tell me where you think we go with this as a culture.
Right. I mean, I think to me what's been interesting has been some of the I don't want to label it conservative, but some of the responses to the White House report that have really said, you know, this isn't about Title IX enforcement. This isn't about what campus officials need to be doing. It's really about these young women who are drinking too much.
Right.
It's about these young women who, you know, make bad decisions in terms of who they date. And so I think what I've been noticing is a real kind of mainstreaming of victim blaming and a real, you know, kind of positing of victim blaming as an appropriate response to this report and to, you know, how much attention is being put on sexual assault on campus right now. And I think, you know, it's dangerous for a lot of reasons. One is that, you know, this Heather McDonald in City Journal has said, well, you know, if a young woman is dumb enough to drink too much, then, you know, we really need to be looking at her activity. Furthermore, if a young person thinks that he or she has been sexually assaulted, it's on that person to, you know, boycott the frat house or to go to their Twitter or Facebook accounts and out their assailant, their alleged assailant. And I think this kind of focus on what the victim or survivor should be doing just shows kind of how much we need a shift in culture and a shift in understanding around what truly is the responsibility of a young person who's been assaulted versus what the law says is the responsibility of the campus to keep young people safe. And I think that's what's so important about this report is it's reminding us all that there's a law on the books, right? Title IX, as an earlier speaker said, is about gender equity on campus. And if campus officials are not doing enough to make the educational environment safe for all students, then it's really on the Department of Education to call them out and to hold them accountable through transparent, timely investigations, as opposed to some of these voluntary resolution agreements or some of the kind of more typical ways that these instances have been handled that get dragged out for years and years and years, mm-hmm. and then are put back on the student to kind of figure out how he or she can complete their educational experience while the school drags its feet to investigate the complaint. So I think it's about culture shift, and I think it's about enforcement, and I think it's about the general public understanding that this isn't something that should be outsourced to an individual to take care of for himself or herself, but it's actually the responsibility of the federal government and campus officials.
Amanda.
I think that the idea of a needed culture shift is so important, and I think both in terms of kind of gender issues and also just about sexual consent in general. And I think there's a lot of exciting work being done, student-led work being done on campuses around the country, including locally. The group Force Upsetting Rape Culture is based here in Baltimore, and you know they've done a lot of work around trying to promote a consent culture where sexuality is looked at as something that you really have to enthusiastically be interested in order to provide consent and kind of changing the messaging around trying to get a girl drunk in order to get her to sleep with you and kind of these ideas that are really more coercive about sexual conduct on campus.
BC Okuba Deja, I want you to kind of jump in too as well, because I mean this is the questions I'm raising here are questions I'm thinking universities can ask and can sometimes also be used as an excuse not to address it.
Once colleges receive a report of possible sexual assault or sexual violence, OCR expects them to take action to look into it to determine whether it rises to the level of a hostile environment. And so the touching or somebody rubbing up against you at a party may not be enough to get you kicked off campus, for example. It has to be enough. It has to be unwelcome, and it has to be enough to create what's called a hostile environment on campus. And if so, then you're referred to generally a hearing panel to decide if it seems like it's more likely than not that you you sexually assaulted someone. And so I think that's important to keep in mind. And on the issue of the agreements with OCR, just because they're called voluntary resolution agreements doesn't mean that they're not legally binding. Once an institution enters into an agreement with OCR, regardless of whether OCR finds a violation or if the institution enters into the agreement voluntarily, the effect is the same. The institution must fulfill those terms. If it doesn't, then OCR could initiate enforcement or administrative proceedings to terminate federal funding, which is a very rare outcome. But the stick at the end of a voluntary resolution or violation resolution is the same.
410-319-8888 is number here. Let's hear your thoughts. And Bruce, you're on the air.
Yeah. So I'm listening to what you're saying, and so institutions should enforce any type of sexual assault. I agree with that. Mm-hmm. But on the other token, I believe in power of the individual. I believe that. A man can be a masculine and still be a gentleman. And so I'm 60 years old, and I probably grew up as a teenager, adolescent, as a young man. The stupid locker room talk, the conquest of guys, it's about them not having class. It's even about some of the stuff that's in our popular culture. Here's what has to happen. My parents weren't perfect, but they guided me. So the parents, the uncles, the neighbors, the people have to tell other men how to act like a gentleman. You know, it's the power of the individual. And in some token, sometimes even women send mixed messages too. And I'm not, but you got to teach kids, even my kids in the neighborhood, give them some advice once in a while. Tell them about being strong spiritually as a man or a woman, but being strong as a man, masculine, is about being a gentleman too. And you don't want to exploit any person, man or woman.
Bruce, Lawrence?
Well, I mean, I agree with a lot of what he's saying, except I want to push back a little bit on the point that it's the power of the individual, because he mentioned the family, the social structure, and I would go even further, the media. As he correctly, I think, intuits, the social structure plays a role. As a matter of fact, the social structure transmits values about what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. And so in some cases, if parents are not as active as they should be, I think we really need to look at the media, because the media at the age we're talking about is often a primary, if not a very high influence in terms of what are the values that young people are engaged in, or what are the values that young people adopt. And so, again, I think when I look at those three cultures of young men coming from families with power, fraternities, or athletes, we're talking about men, young men coming from cultures where they're in circles that are idealized, where masculinity is idealized around power. And you mentioned that, what is it about power that we need to really think about? And I do think that we have to disassociate masculinity from power, especially power over others and power without consent of others. And it does make me think about, this broadened definition, whether it's catcalling or coming up behind a young lady when she's dancing. I mean, we have to rethink what it means to give consent, or even to approach somebody being assertive. I think we need to be less assertive oftentimes, and not trying to push, not trying to be dominant, not trying to get someone to give us attention. I mean, I think a word or two here, like, how you doing, young lady, or something like that. And if she keeps walking, if she keeps going, we need to leave it alone. We need to learn how not to cross over and push, too far where we're crossing the line where someone is not giving consent. I think oftentimes men keeps pushing beyond the line that they should.
And I think this is the line that I want to kind of talk about in another discussion we can have very soon, because I think we need to kind of talk about what this opens up for us to think about. Mm-hmm. It's because this is a very profound moment, I think. Let's go to a quick call here. John, you're on the air before we have to move on. John?
How you doing, sir? One of the panelists stated that sexual assaults were not being handled by police in a proper manner. And I'm in law enforcement, and I believe that police and state's attorneys take this matter quite seriously. And I think that was an indictment on law enforcement. And then another point is that I do believe that personal behavior should be addressed, and not just blame everything on men and frat houses and fraternities and things such as that. Like, when you go to college, they should have briefings as to how you should conduct your own self.
So, but is that Is that kind of blaming somebody because they dress what might be called a quote-unquote a sexy fashion? Should be it's their fault that they're raped?
No, no, no. I'm not saying that they should be raped. What I'm saying is that if the focus has been fraternities and frat houses and things like that,
mm-hmm.
well, we should educate our young women not to put yourself in these positions or in these areas. If you're saying that, oh, if you go to a frat house, there's a potential for you to be raped or sexually assaulted or something of that manner, well, don't go to those places.
Or how about they don't rape in the first place? That would be
right.
helpful.
Let me make some closing thoughts. Amanda and Danny, closing thoughts. We do have to wrap this up. Amanda, what were you about to say?
Well, I just think that message is, again, putting the onus on the victim to avoid being harmed themselves instead of putting the emphasis on the potential offenders from not, engaging in sexual assault.
And Danny?
Yeah, I think this is this whole culture we have of looking at what the victim has done. And one of the things that was quite sad to me was speaking to a young woman who was a survivor on Tufts campus, and just the amount of time it took for her to realize that she was being assaulted and that she was being victimized because she has spent her life being bombarded with these issues, that the first thing to do is to blame yourself and to look at her own role. So I think we really have to understand what this larger culture of blaming the victim does to people who are actually being assaulted, and the amount of time it takes for them to come to the realization that they deserve help and that their assailant needs to be brought to justice.
Dan McLean, thank you for all you're doing with your writing. It's good to have you with us during this course of conversation. I would appreciate everybody who's been on this panel. B.C. Okobadejo, good to have you in the studio with us as well. Attorney with Ballard Spahr, Dr. Lawrence Brown, who joins us often. I'm glad he was with us. Amanda Cardone-Liban. That telephone number for Turnaround is?
Yes, the 24-hour helpline for Turnaround is 443-279-0379.
And we'll talk about that. And we're going to come back to this in the next couple of weeks, because I really want to take this off where it needs to be taken off from here, which is to talk about what this means about growing awareness of who we are as men, what is acceptable, what's not acceptable, what are lines, and what we're learning about this, how this is changing, how we need to use this to begin to change the consciousness around sexuality in our own culture, which I think is kind of the most important line piece of all this, at least for me. So good to have the four of you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a very brief break and come back with the great Holly Neer. She's coming to Baltimore, so don't go away.